You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. This is a reading of the Bhagavad Gita in the West, collected works of Rudolf Steiner. This is lecture 11 in this set. It is, however, in the second cycle embedded in this collected work. It is lecture 6, given in Helsinki on June 2nd, 1913. It really is exceedingly difficult in our Western civilization to speak intelligently and intelligibly about such a work as the Bhagavad Gita. This is because the currently dominant tendency is to interpret any spiritual work of this kind as a kind of doctrine, an abstract teaching or a philosophy, which makes it hard for people to come to a sound judgment in such matters. They like to approach such spiritual creations from the ideal or conceptual point of view. Here we touch upon something that makes it most difficult in our time to gain a true judgment about the great historical impulses in human evolution. How often, for instance, do people point out that this or that saying occurring in the Gospels as the teaching of Christ can be found in some earlier work no less profoundly expressed? Then they say, quote, "You see, it is the same teaching, after all," close quote. Certainly, that is not incorrect, because in countless instances it can be shown that the teachings of the Gospels occur in earlier spiritual works. Yet, while the statement is not incorrect, it may be nonsense from the standpoint of a truly fundamental knowledge of human evolution. People's thinking will have to get accustomed to this and realize that a statement can be perfectly correct and yet nonsense. Until we stop seeing this as a contradiction in terms, we will remain unable to judge certain matters in a truly unbiased way. For instance, one could call the Bhagavad Gita one of the greatest creations of the human spirit, a creation that has not been surpassed in later times. If one were to add that what entered the world with the revelation inherent in the Christ impulse is something altogether different, something to which the Bhagavad Gita could not attain, even if its beauty and greatness were increased 100 times, these two statements do not contradict each other. They may seem to do so according to the habits of modern abstract thinking. Yet in no sense is it truly a contradiction. Indeed, one might go further and ask, quote, "When was that mightiest word spoken that may be regarded as giving the impulse to the human ego, so that it may take its place in the evolution of humankind?" Close quote. That significant word was uttered at the moment Krishna spoke to Arjuna, when he poured into Arjuna's ears the most powerful, incisive, burning words to quicken the consciousness of self in humanity. In the whole history of human life, we cannot find anything that kindled the human self more mightily than the living force of Krishna's words to Arjuna. Of course, we must not take those words in the way words are so often taken in Western countries, where the noblest words are given merely abstract philosophic interpretations. Any such interpretation would certainly miss the essence of the Bhagavad Gita. In this way, Western scholars today have outrageously misused and tortured the Bhagavad Gita. They have even gone so far as to dispute whether it is more representative of the Sankhya philosophy or of some other school of thought. In fact, a distinguished scholar, in his edition of this poem, has actually printed certain lines in small type, because in his view they ought to be expunged altogether, having crept in by mistake. He thinks nothing is really a part of the Gita except what accords with the Sankhya, or at the most with the Yoga philosophy. It may be said, though, that there is no trace in this great poem of what we understand by philosophy today. At most, one could say that in ancient India, certain basic dispositions of soul developed into certain philosophic tendencies. These really have nothing to do with the Bhagavad Gita. or at least not in the sense of being an interpretation or exposition of it. It is altogether unfair to the intellectual and spiritual life of the East to set it side by side with what the West knows as philosophy, because there was no philosophy in the East, in the same sense that there is philosophy in the West. In this respect, the spirit of our age, just beginning, is as yet imperfectly understood. In the last lecture, we spoke of what humanity still has to learn. Above all, we must firmly realize how the human soul, under certain conditions, can meet the being whom we tried to describe from a certain aspect, calling him Krishna. Far more important than any dispute as to whether Sankhya or Vedic philosophy is contained in the Bhagavad Gita is the realization that under certain conditions, Arjuna meets that spirit who prepared the age of self-consciousness. Footnote: Steiner seems here to be using the term, quote, age of self-consciousness, close quote, for what he more usually refers to as the intellectual soul age, 8th century BCE to 15th century CE. End of footnote. To understand it as a real description of world history, of history and of the color and temper of a particular age in which living individual beings are placed before us, is the important point. We have tried to describe their natures, speaking of Arjuna's thoughts and feelings as characteristic of that time, trying to throw light on the new age of self-consciousness and showing how a creative spiritual being preparing for a new age appeared before Arjuna. Now, if we seek a living picture of spiritual beings and their relation to each other, we need to know this Krishna being more exactly. The following may therefore help us complete our picture of him. To penetrate into the region where we can perceive such a mighty being as Krishna, one must have progressed far enough to be able to have real perceptions and real experiences in the spiritual world. That may seem obvious. Yet when we consider what people generally expect of the higher worlds, the matter is by no means self-evident. I have often indicated that innumerable misunderstandings arise from the fact that people wish to lift their lives into the supersensible world while carrying a mass of prejudices with them. They desire to be led along the path into the supersensible toward something already familiar to them in the sense world. In that higher realm, a person perceives forms, for instance, not of dense matter, perhaps, but forms that appear as forms of light. One finds that people expect to hear sounds like the sounds of the physical world. They do not realize that by expecting such things, by entering the higher world with such preconceived ideas, they want a spiritual world just like the sense world, though in a refined form. In the here and now, we are accustomed to color and brightness, so we imagine we will only reach the higher realities if the beings there appear to us in the same way. It ought not to be necessary to say all this, since the supersensible beings are far above all attributes of the senses, and in their true form do not appear at all with sensory qualities, because this would presuppose eyes and ears, that is, sense organs. In the higher worlds, we do not perceive by means of sense organs, but by soul organs. What can happen in this connection, I can illustrate by a childish comparison. Suppose I am describing something to you verbally. Then I feel impelled to represent it with a few strokes on the blackboard, thereby materializing what I have expressed in words. No one would dream of taking the diagram for the reality. It is the same when we express what we have experienced supersensibly by giving it form and color and stamping it in words borrowed from the sense world. In doing so, we do not use our ordinary intellect, but a higher faculty of feeling that translates the supersensible into sense terms. In such a way, our souls live into invisible worlds, for instance, into that of the Krishna being. Then, they feel the need of representing to themselves that being. What they represent, however, is not the being himself, but a kind of sketch, a supersensible diagram. Such sketches, supersensible illustrations, so to speak, are imaginations. The misunderstanding that so often arises amounts to this, that we sensualize what the higher forces of the soul sketch out before us. By interpreting it sensually, we lose its real essence. The essence is not contained in these pictures, but through them it must be dimly felt at first, until by slow degrees we actually begin to see it. I have already mentioned in the second lecture the wonderful dramatic composition of the Bhagavad Gita. I tried to give an idea of the form of the first four discourses. This same dramatic impulse increases from one discourse to the next as we penetrate on and on into the realms of esoteric vision. A sound idea of the artistic composition of this poem may be suggested by looking to see if there is not a central point, a climax to this increase of force and feeling. There are 18 discourses, therefore we might look for the climax in the ninth. In fact, in the ninth chapter, in the very middle, we read these striking words, quote, "Because of your faith, I will tell you the most profound of secrets." Close quote. Here, indeed, is a strange saying that seems to sound abstract, yet has deep significance. Then there follows this most profound mystery. Quote, "All creatures find their existence in me, but I am not limited by them." Close quote. How often people ask today, quote, "What is the judgment of true mystic wisdom about this or that?" Close quote. They want absolute truths, but actually there are no such truths. There are only truths that hold good in certain contexts. In definite circumstances and under definite conditions, they are true. The statement, quote, "I am in all beings, yet they are not in me," close quote, cannot be taken as an abstractly, absolutely true statement. Yet this was spoken out of the deepest wisdom of Krishna at the time when he stood before Arjuna, and its truth is real and immediate, referring to him who is the creator of our inmost being, of our consciousness of self. Through this wonderful approach, we are carried on to the central point of the Gita, to the ninth discourse, where these words are poured out to Arjuna. Then in the 11th discourse, another element enters. What may we expect here, realizing the artistic form of the poem and the deep esoteric truths contained in it? When we take up the 9th and 10th discourses, the very middle of the poem, we notice a remarkable thing, a peculiar difficulty in imagining and bringing to life in our souls the ideas presented to us in this part of the song. As you begin the first discourse, your soul is borne along by the continually increasing currents of feeling and idea. First, immortality is the subject. Then you are uplifted and inspired by the concepts awakened through yoga. All the while, your feeling is being borne along by something in which we might say it can feel at home. We go on, and the poem proceeds in a wonderful way to the concept of the one who inspired the age of self-consciousness. Our enthusiasm is kindled as we approach this being. All this time we are living in definite, familiar feelings. Then comes a still greater climax. We are told how the soul can become ever freer of the outer bodily life. We are led on to the idea so familiar to Indian culture, that the soul can withdraw into itself, realizing inaction in the midst of actions experienced by the body. The soul can become a complete whole, independent of the outer world, as it gradually attains yoga and becomes one with Brahma. In the succeeding discourses, we see how our certainty of feeling, the feeling that can still gain nourishment from daily life, gradually vanishes. Then, as we approach the ninth discourse, our soul seems to rise to inspired heights of unknown experience. If, now, in the 9th and 10th discourses, we try to make the ideas borrowed from ordinary life suffice, we fail. As we reach this part of the song, we feel as if we are standing on a summit of human attainment, born directly out of the esoteric depths of life. If we are to understand it, we must bring to it something that our developing soul must first attain by its own effort. It is remarkable how fine and unerring the composition of the Bhagavad Gita is in this respect. We can get as far as the 5th, 6th, or 7th discourse by developing the concepts given us at the very beginning, in the 1st discourse. In the 2nd, our soul is awakened to realize the presence of the eternal in the ever-changing flow of appearance. Then follows all that passes into the depths of yoga from the 3rd song onward. After this, an altogether new mood begins to appear. Whereas the 1st discourses still have an intellectual quality, reminding us at times of the Western philosophic mode of thinking, something enters now that requires yoga, the devotional mood, for its understanding. As we continue purifying more and more this mood of devotion, our soul rises higher in reverence. The yoga of the 1st discourses no longer carries us. It ceases. And an altogether new mood of soul bears us up into the 9th and 10th discourses, because the words here spoken are no more than a dry, empty sound echoing in our ear if we approach them intellectually. But they radiate warmth to us if we approach them devotionally. One who would understand this sublime poem may start with intellectual understanding and so follow the opening discourses. But as the song proceeds toward the 9th, a deep devotional mood must be awakened. Then the words of the mighty Krishna will be like wonderful music echoing and re-echoing in the soul. Whoever reaches this 9th song may feel this devotional mood as if taking off one's shoes before treading on holy ground, where one feels one must walk with reverence. Then follows the 11th discourse. What can come next, now that we have reached the climax of this devotional mood? When one has risen to the summit where Krishna has led Arjuna, a height that cannot be attained except in esoteric vision or in reverent devotion, it can only be the holy and formless, the supersensible, that appears before one. Then the supersensible can be poured out into imagination. Following this, the uplifted and strengthened soul force that belongs not to the realm of the intellect, but to imaginative perception, can cast into living pictures what in its essential being is without form or likeness. This is what happens at the beginning of the 2nd half of the sublime song, that is to say, around the 11th discourse. Here, after due preparation, the Krishna being to whom Arjuna has been led step by step is conjured up before his soul in imagination. This is where the majestic description in the Indian poem appears in its fullness, where Krishna finally appears in a picture, an imagination. We may truly say that experiences such as this, which only the innermost power of the human soul can undergo, have almost nowhere else been described in such a wonderful way, so filled with meaning. For those who are able to realize it, the imagination of Krishna as Arjuna now describes it will always be of most profound significance. Up to the 10th discourse, we are led by Krishna as by an inspiring being. Now the radiant bliss of Arjuna's opened vision comes before us. Arjuna becomes the narrator and describes his imagination in words so wonderful that one fears to reproduce them. Quote, O Lord, I see within your body all the gods and every kind of living creature. I see Brahma, the creator, seated on a lotus. I see the ancient sages and the celestial serpents. I see infinite mouths and arms, stomachs and eyes, and you are embodied in every form. I see you everywhere, without beginning, middle, or end. You are the Lord of all creation, and the cosmos is your body. You wear a crown and carry a mace and discus. Your radiance is blinding and immeasurable. I see you, who are so difficult to behold, shining like a fiery sun blazing in every direction. You are the supreme changeless reality, the one thing to be known. You are the refuge of all creation, the immortal spirit, the eternal guardian of eternal Dharma. You are without beginning, middle, or end. You touch everything with your infinite power. The sun and moon are your eyes, and your mouth is fire. Your radiance warms the cosmos. O Lord, your presence fills the heavens and the earth and reaches in every direction. I see the three worlds trembling before this vision of your wonderful and terrible form. The gods enter your being, some calling out and greeting you in fear. Great saints sing your glory, praying, "May all be well." The multitudes of gods, demigods, and demons are all overwhelmed by the sight of you. O mighty Lord, at the sight of your myriad eyes and mouths, arms and legs, stomachs and fearful teeth, I and the entire universe shake in terror. O Vishnu, I can see your eyes shining with open mouth. You glitter in an array of colors, and your body touches the sky. I look at you and my heart trembles. I have lost all courage and all peace of mind. When I see your mouths with their fearful teeth, mouths burning like the fires at the end of time, I forget where I am and have no place to go. O Lord, you are the support of the universe. Have mercy on me. Discourse 11, verses 15 through 25, close quote. Such is the imagination that Arjuna beholds when his soul has been raised to that height where an imagination of Krishna is possible. Then we hear what Krishna is echoing across to Arjuna once more as a mighty inspiration. In reality, it is as if it were not merely sounding for the spiritual ear of Arjuna, but echoing down through all the ages that followed. At this point, we begin dimly to perceive what it means when a new impulse is given for a new epoch in the world's history. And when the author of this impulse appears to the clairvoyant gaze of Arjuna, we feel with Arjuna. We remind ourselves that he is in the midst of the turmoil of battle, where brother blood is pitted against its kin. We know that what Krishna has to give depends above all upon the end of the old clairvoyant epoch, together with all that was holy in it, and the beginning of a new epoch. When we reflect on the impulse of this new epoch that was to begin with fratricide, when we rightly understand the impulse that forced its way in through all the swaying concepts and institutions of the preceding epoch, then we get a correct concept of what Krishna lets Arjuna hear. Quote, "I am time, the destroyer of all. I have come to consume the world. Even without your participation, all the warriors gathered here will die. Therefore, arise, Arjuna. Conquer your enemies and enjoy the glory of sovereignty. I have already slain all these warriors. You will only be my instrument. Bhishma, Drona, Jayadratha, Karna, many others are already slain. Kill those whom I have killed. Do not hesitate. Fight in this battle, and you will conquer your enemies." From Discourse 11, 32 through 34, close quote. It was not in order to bring to human ears the voice that spoke of slaying that these words were uttered, but to make them hear the voice that tells of the center in the human being that has to develop in the age to come. Into this center there were focused the highest impulses realizable by humanity at that time, and that there is nothing in human evolution with which the human ego is not connected. Here we find in the Bhagavad Gita something that lifts us up, and sets us on the horizon of the whole of human evolution. When we think of the evolution of humanity over all the earth, and trace it, as we are able to do by means of what is given, for example, in our esoteric science, when in this sense we see the earth as the place where humanity has first been brought to the ego through many different stages, following one another and developing from age to age, when we thus follow the course of evolution through the epochs of time, then we may say to ourselves that having been planted here on earth, the highest these souls can attain is to become free souls. Free, that is what we will become if we bring to full development all the forces latent within us as individual souls. In order to make this possible, Krishna was active, indirectly and almost imperceptibly at first, then ever more definitely, and at last quite directly in the period we have been describing. In all of earthly evolution, there is no being who could give the individual human soul so much as Krishna. If we let the changing moods of this great poem work upon us, we shall gain much more than those who try to read into it pedantic doctrines of Sankhya or yoga philosophies. If we can only dimly feel the dazzling heights that can be reached through yoga, we shall begin to lay hold of the meaning and spirit of such a mighty imagination as that of Arjuna's presented to us here. Even as an image, it is so sublime and forceful that we are able to form some conception of the creative spirit which in Krishna is grafted onto the world. The highest impulse that can speak to the individual speaks through Krishna to Arjuna. The highest to which one can lift oneself by raising to their full pitch all the powers that reside within one's being, that is Krishna. The highest to which one can soar by training oneself and working on oneself with wisdom, that is Krishna. I say expressly the individual soul because, and I say this deliberately, on earth there exists not only the individual human soul, but also humankind. Consider this in connection with all I have tried to give about Krishna, because on earth there are all those concerns that do not belong to the individual alone. Imagine a person feeling the inner impulse to perfect him or herself as far as a human soul can. Then imagine each person separately going on to develop indefinitely. And then there is humankind. For this earthly planet there are matters that bring humankind into connection with the whole universe. With the Krishna impulse coming into each individual soul, let us assume that every soul would have developed in itself a higher impulse, not immediately, nor even up to the present time, but sometime in the future. So that from the age of self-consciousness onward, the stream of humankind's collective evolution would have been split apart. Individual souls would have progressed and unfolded to the highest point, but separately, dispersed, broken apart from each other. Their paths would have diverged further and further as the Krishna impulse worked in each one. Human existence would have been uplifted in the sense that souls individualized themselves and so lifted themselves out of the common current, developing their self-life to the utmost. In this way, the ancient time would have shone into the future like many, many rays from a single star. Every one of these rays would have proclaimed the glory of Krishna far into future cosmic eras. This is the path on which humankind was traveling in the 6th or 8th centuries before the foundation of Christianity. Then from the opposite side something else came in. The Krishna impulse comes into the human soul when from the depths of its own inner being the soul works, creates, and draws forth its powers more and more until it may rise to those realms where it may reach Krishna. But something came toward humanity from outside, which humans could never have reached, through the forces that lived within themselves, something bending down to each individual. The souls that were separating and isolating themselves encountered the same being who came down out of the cosmic universe into the age of self-consciousness from outside. It came in such a way that it belonged to the whole of humanity, to all the earth. This other impulse came from the opposite side. It was the Christ. Though put rather abstractly for the present, we see how a continually increasing individualization was prepared and brought about in humankind, and how, then, those souls that had the impulse to individualize themselves more and more were met by the Christ impulse, leading them once more together into a common humanity. What I have tried to indicate has been a rather preliminary description of the two impulses from the Christ and Krishna. I have tried to show how closely the two impulses come together in the age of the midpoint of evolution, even though they come from diametrically opposite directions. We can make very great mistakes by confusing these two revelations. What I have developed today in a rather general way we will make more concrete in the succeeding lectures. But I would close today with a few words that may simply and clearly summarize what these two impulses are, truly the most important in human evolution. If we look back to all that happened between the 10th century before Christ and the 10th century afterward, we may say that into the universe the Krishna impulse flowed for every individual human soul, and into the earth the Christ impulse came for all humankind. Observe that for those who think specifically, quote, all of humankind, close quote, by no means signifies the same as the mere sum total of all individual human souls. The end of Lecture 11.